It's the NPR News Update podcast for a new week, Monday, October 20. I'm Phil Picardi. Today, Liberian Americans in the Twin Cities remember Ebola victims. The governor candidates chew over the issues in another debate. Some people emerge from foreclosure with money in their pockets, trying to sue the state corrections department, and two Minnesota music giants are gone. First, family members of Thomas Duncan, the Liberian man who died of Ebola, are now out of quarantine in Dallas. The news that the family is healthy came as a big relief to the hundreds of Liberian Americans in the Twin Cities who attended a prayer service last night. As Matt Sepik reports, the service was both a memorial for Duncan and other Ebola victims, and also a call to arms to fight the disease.
With his picture splashed across every media platform in the world, Thomas Eric Duncan has become the global face of an illness that has killed thousands of people in West Africa. Facing almost as much scrutiny as Louise Tro, Duncan's fiancée, the woman he traveled to Dallas to visit. With the 21-day virus incubation period over, Tro's appearance via Skype before a packed Brooklyn Center church was a triumphant moment for Pastor Harding Smith, who led last night's service in Brooklyn Center.
I'm free. Ebola free today.
Woo! Yes! Yes! Thank you, Jesus!
The service was part religious revival with high energy, singing and dancing, and part public health symposium that included a Q&A with a state health department epidemiologist about Ebola warning signs. The Twin Cities Liberian American population is among the largest in the U.S., and while community leaders here have been stridently admonishing their fellow immigrants not to travel, one group was there urging exactly the opposite. Tarlo Kuiwampa, a nurse with a group called the Liberian Diaspora Medical Boots on the Ground, sat at a table at the entrance trying to recruit doctors and nurses to go to West Africa to fight Ebola.
The various NGOs are playing their part, but Liberians need to take the lead in terms of trying to help our own people.
Kuiwampa says she hopes to sign up 200 medical personnel to travel. She says there's been interest, but also concern about immigration snafus.
They would like to make sure that upon their departure for this deployment, that coming back to the United States should not be an obstacle.
Liberian Americans at the service last night were generally complimentary of U.S. government efforts to fight Ebola. Dekante Kofa Sawyer, a Twin Cities woman whose Liberian husband died of Ebola after traveling to Nigeria, says she welcomes the deployment of American troops to build treatment centers and provide logistical support. But Sawyer, like the others, says it's up to Liberians here in the United States to take charge of the effort.
It's not just enough to say President Obama helped Liberia, helped West Africa. What are we, you know, Liberians here, Liberian Americans and Africans here, what are we doing to help lead this fight?
Sawyer also says family members of Ebola victims who have the added burden of grieving from thousands of miles away should not be afraid to seek mental health counseling. Sawyer says getting mental health treatment may not be the norm in the Liberian American community, but she says these are not normal times. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Brooklyn Center.
With just over 2 weeks left until Election Day, DFL Governor Mark Dayton and Republican challenger Jeff Johnson used their fourth debate yesterday to sharpen some familiar criticisms about political philosophies, health care, and economic issues. They also offered competing ideas on guns and budget surpluses. Tim Pugmire reports.
The candidates squared off in a live television debate at Hamline University in St. Paul in front of a small audience of students and supporters. Johnson opened by pledging to stand up for the, quote, forgotten middle class by lowering taxes and growing jobs. Johnson said if the state has a budget surplus, he would use that money to make changes in the income taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, and corporate taxes.
We are not competitive with other states in our region. We're certainly not competitive with the states that surround us, and you can go to any border community, and the people there will tell you that, and it's hurting Minnesotans, and it's hurting us from a job standpoint.
Later in the debate, Johnson said he had no clue how he would define a middle-class income. Dayton said he thinks the starting point is around $50,000 a year. Dayton said he wants to help the middle class by trying to lower property taxes during a second term. He said he would use part of any budget surplus to expand the state's child care tax credit.
So it includes more of the middle class working parents, as well as to increase the amount So it keeps pace with the rising costs. It's something that I proposed in the last legislative session. Unfortunately, it was not adopted, but I would press for that.
Dayton and Johnson also highlighted their differing views on gun control. Dayton said requiring criminal background checks for online and gun show purchases would close what he described as a huge loophole.
We want to find out first if they're psychiatrically capable of handling that responsibility or if they have a criminal background, which should disqualify them. So why would we make that consistent statewide? I believe we should.
Johnson said he would oppose such measures. He said there are already enough laws on the books to keep people protected.
Going forward with new legislation and having this cultural war that we love to have about guns, I don't think that really benefits anyone in the end.
Both men said they own guns and have used them within the past year. They both agreed to continue the policy of allowing gun owners to carry weapons inside the state capitol building. Johnson took aim at Dayton with criticisms on his leadership, aspects of the Viking Stadium bill, the potential release of sex offenders, and the state health insurance exchange, MNsure. Johnson said health care in Minnesota has been sucked down to the national average under Dayton.
It's been an unmitigated disaster. And I know, Governor, you said that you don't lose any sleep over that, but I do, trying to figure out how we're going to fix that mess once I'm governor.
Dayton said MNsure is far from perfect, but he added that there are thousands who now have health care access that didn't have it before. Dayton criticized Johnson for offering few specifics about his budget plans, his admiration of Wisconsin Republican Governor Scott Walker, and his ties to the Tea Party.
You kept saying to Tea Party groups, I want your endorsement. And then when after the primary, you said, well, I never asked for their endorsement. So you got to take one position at the beginning of the year and stick with it all the way through.
This was the second time this month that organizers of a debate left out Hannah Nicollet, the Independence Party candidate for governor. Nicollet and some of her supporters protested that decision outside the event.
You know, there is no legal distinction between myself as a candidate and Jeff Johnson and Mark Dayton, since we are a major party in the state of Minnesota, so the excuses that we've been given for not being included are not valid.
Nicollet said she's also excluded from the campaign's final debate, which is scheduled for Halloween night on public television. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
We'll stick with Tim Pugmire for the next report. He tells us a Minnesota Senate panel meets this week to take up an ethics complaint against a DFL lawmaker.
Senate Republicans filed the complaint last month accusing DFL Senator Jeff Hayden of Minneapolis of using his elected office for personal gain. Hayden resigned from the Board of Community Action of Minneapolis after a state audit found the nonprofit had misused taxpayer money. Hayden insists his conduct was lawful and ethical. The hearing is set for Wednesday afternoon. Republicans also want the Subcommittee on Ethical Conduct to look at allegations that Hayden pressured Minneapolis school officials to work with another organization that he also had ties to. Those allegations also prompted a separate GOP ethics complaint against DFL Senator Bobby Joe Champion of Minneapolis. That hearing is scheduled for November 5th. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Trustees of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system are considering another undergraduate tuition freeze. Alex Friedrich has more.
The board will discuss the move this week as part of a two-year, $1.39 billion budget request to lawmakers. System officials say the freeze would save the average university student more than $200 a year and the average two-year college student $145 a year. But trustee Phil Krinke says he's worried the legislature might pay for the freeze at the expense of other inflation-related costs. Then it would be up to trustees to make up the difference.
So it's going to be cut classes, cut instruction, cut administrative costs.
The board is scheduled to vote on the request next month. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The city of Winona is removing nearly 100 ash trees from public parks and city boulevards. Elizabeth Baer reports.
City officials decided to remove infested and non-infested ash trees that are located within a mile of places where emerald ash borer has been found. Winona Assistant City Manager Keith Nelson says plans are in place to remove and replace the trees before the emerald ash borer kills them.
If we waited for the emerald ash borer to do its thing, they would be all dying within a couple of years, and we just would be inundated. We couldn't handle that many trees dying at one time. So we're just making it a gradual transition.
Nelson says the city will continue to treat some of its healthy ash trees with chemicals. Around the state, a dozen cities, including Minneapolis, St. Paul, Caledonia, and La Crescent, have also removed ash trees as a way to stop the spread of emerald ash borer. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
People who go through foreclosure generally don't see a silver lining to the process. After all, they lose their homes and their credit rating tanks. But under the right circumstances, Minnesotans in foreclosure can walk away from the process with tens of thousands of dollars in their pockets. Annie Baxter explains.
A few months ago, a Twin Cities realtor named Chris Bailey got a call from a client who was behind on his mortgage. The lender was about to foreclose on the home, which was located in one of the suburbs, and Bailey wanted to figure out what kind of options the homeowner still had.
And so I dropped everything to contact the lender and the law firm handling it and the county to find out when the sheriff's sale was going on.
The sheriff's sale starts the last phase of a foreclosure. The lender places a bid, which primarily sets a baseline sale price for the home. And in this case, the bid came in low at only $225,000. That was far less than the house was worth. And even more importantly, less than the balance owed on the mortgage. Chris Bailey was so surprised at the low bid that he asked the sheriff's office to confirm the number.
Just want to double check. You didn't read that wrong. Okay, and then I'd like to see that in writing and make sure that we're all squared away and can move forward. Because it does sound too good to be true.
At that point, Bailey was excited because he knew the house would fetch way more than the lender's offer of $225,000. And under Minnesota's foreclosure laws, Bailey would have at least 6 months from the sheriff's sale to sell it. It worked. A buyer paid $300,000 for the home. The lender got paid back the $225,000 it said it needed at the sheriff's sale. The lawyers and realtors got their cuts. And there was still a tidy sum left over for the client. NPR agreed to identify him only as Charles to protect his privacy. Charles lost his home, but he came away with $40,000 free and clear.
It was nice to be able to have something to, you know, move on with, you know, and we're expecting a baby.
Experts say Charles' situation is uncommon, but has been cropping up with greater frequency in Minnesota over the past few years. Exactly how much isn't clear, but it helps if the lender underbids on the property. In Charles' case, the bank handling the mortgage was Wells Fargo, which was taking direction from a federal agency that owned the loan. Spokesman Tom Goida says when Wells Fargo is itself the owner of the loan, the bids are the result of a complex calculation.
We do use an approach that's based primarily on the value of the property and on anticipated holding costs.
Holding costs include overhead for things like maintenance, property taxes, marketing, and other resale expenses. Guy Sakala, the publisher of the trade publication Inside Mortgage Finance, says in the housing crisis, banks learned the perils of managing and selling foreclosed properties themselves.
It soon turned into a huge bottomless hole for many banks. They ended up with large portfolios of real estate owned, or REO as they call it, that they had to maintain, that was sucking revenue out of their bottom lines, but they didn't know what else to do.
Sakala says banks are savvier now and more willing to get properties off their books at break-even costs or even a modest loss. He says lenders may well underbid on a property at the sheriff's sale to boost the chances someone else will buy it and take it off their hands. But homeowners in foreclosure might not know those low bids can help them. Ed Nelson is spokesman for the Minnesota Homeownership Center. He says many homeowners don't even realize they can still sell their properties during the 6 months after the sheriff's sale. And unless they investigate the matter themselves, they may never even learn of a bank's low bid.
The bank will never tell you. The new investor will never tell you. A letter won't come in the mail to say, you know, on this date, your house sold for this amount. You won't ever get a letter like that.
Even for those homeowners shrewd enough to walk away with some cash, the windfall does nothing to protect their credit rating. Wells Fargo says it still reports such situations to the credit rating agency as foreclosures. Annie Baxter, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A man imprisoned in Minnesota for more than 3 years longer than his original sentence is trying to sue the Department of Corrections. The problem, there's no state law he can cite for his lawsuit. That is something both legal scholars and lawmakers find unusual and say should be fixed. Brant Williams reports.
In 2004, 34-year-old Lavelle Bible was convicted of two counts of criminal sexual conduct and sentenced to serve 53 months in prison. Court records show that while his sentence expired in 2008, Bible was repeatedly sent back to prison for multiple violations of his parole. In 2011, a Chisago County judge ruled that the corrections department violated the law and ordered Bible be released from Rush City Prison. In Minnesota, offenders serve two-thirds of their sentences in prison and one-third on a form of parole called supervised release. As a convicted sex offender, Bible was ordered to serve an extra term of parole called conditional release. Bible's lawyer, Terry Duggins, says corrections officials kept adding more time to his sentence each time he violated the terms of his conditional release.
They just kept adding it on. You know, 180 days here, 360 days here, 365. And all of that 1,115 days was beyond the end date of his original sentence. And that's where the problem was.
In 2010, the State Court of Appeals ruled in favor of another Minnesota inmate who challenged similar punishments by the Corrections Department. The ruling said the state had to allow offenders to serve supervised and conditional release terms one after the other. So Lavelle Bible couldn't be punished for violating conditional release when he technically hadn't served it. Duggins would like someone at the Department of Corrections to be held accountable and get some compensation for Bible for the extra time he served. But that's easier said than done, says William Mitchell College of Law professor Brad Colbert.
Because you just can't show there was a mistake. Generally, you have to show something, especially for a constitutional claim, is more than a mistake.
Colbert says the length of time Bible spent in prison past his sentence is very unusual. Department of Corrections spokeswoman Sarah Latusek declined to comment, saying the department doesn't talk about pending litigation. However, in court documents, corrections officials argued its actions were lawful and appropriate. Even if Bible could prove the state made a mistake, there's no state law to allow him to sue. In the last legislative session, state lawmakers passed a law allowing for compensation for people imprisoned for a crime they did not do. But the law doesn't apply to people like Bible, who did the crime but spent too much time in prison.
I think we ought to have some kind of system set up to recognize those situations.
Senator Ron Latz is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee and a Democrat who represents St. Louis Park. He says he would support a law that makes some type of system of redress for inmates who, through a clerical error or no fault of their own, overstay their prison sentences.
The trick would be distinguishing between those kind of technical errors in the system as opposed to differences of legal interpretation about the application of a law, something of that nature.
Latz's Republican colleague on the Judiciary Committee, Senator Warren Limmer, agrees that the state should provide an avenue for people like Lavelle Bible to be compensated. Limmer, a former Hennepin County corrections officer, says corrections officials do their best to follow the law, but he says the buck stops with the state.
We're the ones that are responsible for releasing that individual according to the court order that put him there.
Bible has another option. He can file a claim with the Joint House-Senate Subcommittee on Claims. In 2010, the committee awarded a man more than $34,000 after a sentencing error left him incarcerated for more than a year longer than his original sentence. It is not clear how many others like Bible were kept in prison longer than their sentences. Earlier this year, the state attorney general's office said there were 50 offenders eligible to be released based on the court ruling used to free Bible in 2011. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Iconic Minnesota jazz broadcaster Leigh Kamen has died at the age of 92. After a career spanning more than six decades, Kamen is remembered as a tireless promoter of the music he loved, a consummate professional, and a truly nice guy. Ewan Kerr reports.
Leigh Kamen was a fixture on NPR for almost 3.5 decades with his show, The Jazz Image. His voice was as smooth as the music he put on the air. Indeed, he said he modeled his announcing on the sound of jazz.
In tempo and time, with the music, it often, generates the way I phrase and the dead air and the syllables that go tumbling through the night.
Kamen made it sound effortless, but there were years of work behind his sound. Born in 1922, he became fascinated with jazz as a boy in central Minnesota. After getting a job in the school newspaper at 17, he met Duke Ellington for the first time by tracking him down at the train station in St. Paul. A first job as an announcer in Duluth led to a string of others, including a stint at Armed Forces Radio. In the early 50s, he moved to New York City. There he broadcast live on station WOV from a specially built studio in the ballroom of the Palm Hotel in Harlem. It was a place to hear great music and to be seen.
It could be Edward Kennedy Ellington, an undiscovered Quincy Jones, and an actor by the name of Sidney Poitier, or it could be Harry Belafonte.
In time, though, Kamen returned to his home state.
Out here, a little closer to the northern star in the land of lakes, the Milling City, Minneapolis, exactly located at 211 6th Street in the heart of the Milling City, Minneapolis, Minnesota, from the most elegant, the plush and the lush, new jazz club of the country, Freddy's.
Kamen was part of a team that broadcast jazz live from clubs around the country. Drummer Kenny Horst, who owned and ran the Artist Quarter Jazz Club for many years, says he remembers first hearing Kamen when he was just a teenager.
And I remember turning on the radio and listening to him in my car, and he was playing so excited me that I rear-ended the guy in front of me.
Horst is 71 now and says he and Kamen teased each other for decades over that accident.
I saw him just in August, and he said, "Sorry about the car."
After working at several stations in the Twin Cities, Kamen launched the Jazz Image at NPR. Tom Wilmoth was his board operator between 1980 and 84. He says Kamen was the consummate broadcast professional.
So he knew how to work the microphone in a really old-school professional way. You were going to be able to understand every word, and it was enunciated. And sometimes the images he would go into were pretty trippy. Balloons over the lakes and things, and you think, did I really hear him say that?
Wilmoth says Kamen was self-effacing, and it was only after he had worked with him for some time that he learned of Kamen's connections to jazz history.
I had worked with Lay for over 3 years before I even heard him mention in passing that he had spoken with Duke Ellington, or the fact that he had talked to Charlie Parker on the telephone. And he had a recording of that, and that he'd had Billie Holiday in his New York City apartment.
When asked, as he was wrapping up the Jazz Image in 2007, why he felt jazz was so important, Leigh Kamen said it was because he believed jazz was an important language. He called it a language of democracy in the United States.
It's a product of a very special kind of event and series of events called slavery. And to lower the barriers, the slaves, through their music, built their church and music of the church, which became a foundation for a band like Count Basie.
Funeral services for Leigh Kamen will be private. However, planning is underway for a jazz community celebration of his life at a later date. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
One of the Twin Cities' most renowned classical composers has died. Stephen Paulus passed away yesterday at the age of 65 from complications related to a stroke he suffered last year. Paulus wrote hundreds of works, including nearly 60 orchestral scores, 10 operas, and 150 choral pieces. To talk about it, Philip Brunel, artistic director and founder of the choral music organization Vocal Essence, joined Kathy Werzer this morning.
He was Stephen Paulus was such a bright star when it comes to composing music.
Oh, absolutely. And just a really friendly, wonderful man. If you wanted to commission something from him, he just said, "Well, what kind of chorus is it? Are they good? Are they bad? I'll write for anybody." I mean, he was just that kind of wonderful person that you really enjoyed having a chance to be with.
What were his most significant accomplishments as a composer?
Well, I think the fact is that he really understood the voice. And some composers really get it, and he was one, so that when you sang his music, it just felt natural to you. It didn't feel like you had to struggle in order to make the notes work. It didn't mean that the music was necessarily easy, but the fact is it just had a real vocalism about it that made you just feel
that this was somebody who loved singing, and he really reflected that in what he wrote.
What was your working relationship like with him?
He was easy in the sense that he knew your group. He knew Vocal Essence, for instance, so he knew how to write for that. He also knew individual voices, and so that part of it, it was a delight. He wrote a piece for us called The Day Is Done that we've sort of made it almost a signature tune, and he had this wonderful, beautiful sense of the style. He also, you know, would say, I'm going to get this to you. It may be at the last minute, but you'll have it. And that sort of went with his personality. He was just a real star for Minnesota.
Was he always working and massaging a piece to the very end?
Oh, yes. He made his living as a composer. He wasn't a teacher in addition. He would go do workshops and things like that. But he really kept up his composition style. And, you know, he would hear a piece and go, well, maybe we could make a few changes. And he was never against making changes if he felt that it would improve the piece.
Any particular favorite pieces beyond the one you mentioned?
Well, of course, his early opera called The Village Singer is the one that he wrote back in 1979 for the singer. It was an opera, and that sort of put him on the opera map. And then when he wrote a few years ago a piece about the Holocaust that was called To Be Certain of the Dawn, which he did with Minnesota Orchestra over at the Basilica, and that was another kind of important work. And then just, as you mentioned, these hundreds of wonderful choral pieces that have been done. One of them was sung at President Reagan's funeral, and, of course, a ton of Christmas music. He was famous for writing many, many things that were for all parts of the year. And the great thing is that, though he is no longer with us, this music will continue to be.
Was he a fun person to work with?
Oh, yes. He had a great sense of humor. You'd do a passage, and he might say, though he knew better, he might say something to you like, oh, is that what it sounds like? Well, he knew what it sounded like, but, you know, he would just have little humorous things. And so he always kept people very much at ease because he knew that with singers, the important thing is to keep your voice relaxed. You'll sound best that way rather than, you know, full of tension. So he just had an innate way of making singers feel very much at home. And so they therefore loved a chance to sing his music, and particularly to sing it if he was present.
All right. I appreciate your time this morning. Always a pleasure. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you, Kathy.
Philip Brunel and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. Thanks for listening. More Minnesota news tomorrow on the podcast.